Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman, and I am with you till 10 o'clock tonight on this rainy evening in the Chicago area. Broadcasting high atop the mouth of the Chicago River and keeping you up to date on all the weather news today as we are in a thunderstorm watch in some parts of the Chicago area, the listening area, and we'll keep you up to date and make sure that you have the latest information from the National Weather Service. And what is rolling through the area? It's been a tough couple days for some of our area. Just north of us last night, talking about tornado warnings and sirens going off in different towns and suburbs. And, of course, today as well, some tornado warnings out in the DeKalb area and out west by Aurora. So some difficult, tense moments for the Chicago area when it comes to inclement severe weather. And we here at WGN Radio have you covered. So stick tight. We got a great show lined up tonight. I'm very excited to be on the air. It seems like it's been a while since it was last week, Pete. We didn't have a show this week, did we? Oh, we did on Monday. We came through for a little bit on a stretch. We did a stretch. We did a spell on Monday. And we're going to be back tomorrow night as well, as the White Sox are on the road in Seattle starting tomorrow. So they do that that late game. Always love the late game, but that gives us an hour or so beforehand to. Hour and a half before the Sox beat the Mariners out in Seattle. So if they get that game in, because it's always raining in Seattle. I don't know how they play baseball up there.
When you went to Seattle for vacation, it looked like the weather was wonderful while you were there.
I had a rideshare driver who said, "You're here for the 1 week where it's nice."
It's been great.
Yeah.
Now, did you get... I know you're a White Sox fan, mm-hmm. but did you get any like Seattle Mariners, Seahawks, any type of paraphernalia? No.
The only thing we do, my son Miles, he gets a, what do you call it, like a snow globe from every city that he goes to. And I have to say, I'm pretty proud as a parent because we've put an emphasis on travel, at least domestic travel. We hadn't done anything outside the country. And we've talked about it a lot on the various nighttime shows and the morning show and Cochrane show. But this idea that, you know, that's something that I wanted to, if we have the ability to do it and I have the vacation time and the resources, I'd love to get in the car and go places we haven't been before.
Mm-hmm.
This time around, we went out to Seattle and Portland, but so he was able to get a snow globe in Seattle and a snow globe in Portland. And we went to Portland and we're like, let's get a snow globe. But we didn't fly out of Portland. We flew to Seattle, drove down to the Oregon coast in Portland and rented a car and then went back up to Seattle because it was cheaper to fly out.
Mm-hmm.
So snow globes are not a thing.
Rain globes.
Rain globes are a thing. But snow globes are not, if you're not at the airport, there's no snow globe store. It's not like you can go into the Walgreens and find a snow globe for Chicago. You know, they're few and far between. And we asked our concierge in Portland at the hotel, and they're like, Powell's. Went over to Powell's Bookshop, and they're like, nah, we got rain globes. Oh. Then they're like, go to this store, go to that store. So before we jet out of town in Portland, we were running around like it was, sweating trying to find a snow globe. And then my wife, she's just like, she's like, all right, I just ordered it from Amazon.
Oh, no.
We had no other choice. We had to get on the road. So we got it. It actually beat us home. And then we got home, and there's the Portland, the snow globe. And it's the exact same one you would get
if you
in
were
the
there.
Airport.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm sure if you go to the Portland airport, it's there. But, yeah, so that's Mariners, no. The Seahawks, no. We don't mess with any of the sporting teams. Although when we went to Pittsburgh last year, we went to a Steelers preseason game.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, but we didn't get a Steelers jersey.
The Powell's Bookstore is one of the fine establishments that carries my wife's greeting cards. Yeah,
we were in a port. We were in one of the. I wanted to say we should probably save this for off air when I'm, you know, sit next to you for 24/7. Forget that we never have any small talk. We get to air, and I'm like, oh, so you know what, Pete? I was thinking about you when I was in Nob Hill. We were in Portland, and there was a store. There was an independent card store that was in Nob Hill, and I went in there. And it's funny because my wife, she just kind of walked around and looked at stuff. I went straight to the cards and just turned everyone over. And I asked the woman, I'm like, you do La Familia? You don't know what I'm talking about? You know what? I'm out of here. I'm going to go wait on the sidewalk. And I got upset at them for not knowing what I was talking about. But yeah, so that's great to know. I wish I would have spent some time in the card section at Powell's. Instead, we were looking for snow globes and being directed towards rain globes. That's a new thing, rain globes.
What is the difference between the two?
You tell me. I don't even know. They're a different shape. They're like cylinder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit more like the I don't even.
But it's
like
the same.
It's like
it's
a
the
bath
same
toy.
Basic function. You just shake it and and except it looks like it's raining.
Yeah, exactly. I think all that's right. The idea. So yeah. Anyway, yesterday the reason I bring this up is yesterday I spent some time looking at the collection that Miles has in his room, and he's got some good stuff. He has now, just off because my brother lived in California, so we would go out to California, and then we would always be like, hey, man, can we take your car for a day? And we would kind of go to San Francisco and Santa Barbara and other places like that and drive up the coast. And he has a snow globe for San Diego, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Monterey, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. What? That's the whole West Coast. Nothing on the East Coast. But the whole West Coast is covered. We're done. I got the West Coast covered by 12 years old. That's not bad, right?
It's great.
My wife, good start. My wife never went on a vacation. Her family didn't believe in vacations for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't into the family vacation. So she doesn't know. So it was her first time in all these cities too. But it's just amazing. My family had we kind of put a premium on the same thing, like the idea that we would get into the old Chevy truck. And there's some great stories of it breaking down at different places. Famously in Bangor, Maine, where we were trying to get, it was rush hour, and we were trying to, on an expressway ramp, and the old Chevy truck's battery went out. It's like, my dad had he had completely turned it out. Like it was turned. He had created in the back, it was a pickup truck, but he had created like a camping kind of thing, you know, behind it with all these little drawers and stuff. So we went on the road, but it was still an old truck. And it was not equipped for the mileage that was put on it. So I remember we just blocked. Like it was, today I'd probably have a heart attack. Like the anxiety would kill me,
man.
That I was blocking people from getting off of their exit at rush hour in any situation. But in that situation, we're like, doo, 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 we'll leave the car here. Let's go find a Sears. Let's go find a.
Oh my God.
Just left the car there. went and found a battery, went and put it back in, and like, boom, boom, boom. All right, let's go see Bar Harbor. Let's go. That's essentially it. We got a great show lined up tonight. I'm very excited about it. We're talking all about snow globes and road trips and nothing to do with what we're talking about. Alex Poppy is a Chicago author. She was actually born in Lombard and grew up in Lombard. Her first novel is out. It's called Moxie. And she is written a ton of short stories, but this is her first novel. And she is currently teaching at American University in Iraq. She's teaching Iraqi kids that were there for the American invasion. They're now college kids. And we'll talk about that experience and what that's like to be an American teaching Iraqi kids, but also about her first novel that's coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. And also John Schmidt's back, or I should say, our John Schmidt series, our historian we've been talking to in the last couple of weeks, where we go out of the studio to different places that are considered hidden Chicago landmarks. Last week, we did the Balbo Column. Remember that? We talked about Mussolini giving the Balbo Column to, and how we are hiding it over there in the museum campus. Eh, don't look over here. This is from a fascist. And tonight, we talk about, and this is very exciting, the Clarence Wagner's Bridge. This is the Clarence Wagner Memorial Bridge, a forgotten tribute to a forgotten political kingpin. We'll go out to the bridge coming up here a little bit later in the 9 o'clock hour. So lots to do, including Heather Sherrone, like I said, who's going to be coming up in the 7:30 hour to talk about all things Chicago politics. We got a big show lined up. I'm excited. Why don't we take our first break, and we will come back and get to Heather Sherrone here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. I saw all of Ben Bradley's Instagram when he was doing that. Social media. They actually are following one of the airliners that is being put out of commission to New Mexico. That's what a great story. There's a whole, and I'm sure this will be a big part of it, but there's a whole movement or society of people that are really into planes, and they came out for that. Like, that was a big moment. I'm not a planes guy, not an aviation guy. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love to fly. Don't get me wrong. I love the technology of being able to watch three movies on a flight to Seattle.
I find it interesting that people are fascinated with planes, and I know that people like really like trains.
Yeah,
and that like there's like an old, there a couple of months ago or a few weeks ago there was an old locomotive that was like back in business, and I saw tons of people like photos of this old train going by. I'm like,
I did a story. I know I did a story. There's a lot of unbelievable trains, and this could have changed because this was years ago. This dates my time of how long I've been doing this, but 2002. 2003 maybe, where I went up to Northbrook, and I guess the Northbrook line, that where you would be at the train station in Northbrook, there's also freight trains that go through there, and that if you're, you know, and if you're in any of the forest preserve back there, you can, there's bridges over there that you can watch, but these are all the big trains that come in from Canada, and they flow all the way down, they go right through there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see all sorts of modern trains, and there was a group at the time, and again, it's been years, so I don't know if they still do it, that would come out at, you know, right around this time, twilight, and they would watch the trains, or train watchers, train spotters.
Yeah.
And they would sit there in with their lawn chairs and whatever, and they'd watch these big trains go by, and I'm like, what an interesting thing. And it was, they were really, they're very passionate about it.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming it's the same with the airlines. Same, yeah. It took me about 3 minutes to be like, is there a Chili's around here? What kind of cool restaurants do you have in Northbrook that might be cleaner than the ones in the city? That's how I always do it. I know there's a lot of independent, cool, small businesses, but I'm talking about like the Applebee's and the Chili's and the Culver's, the stuff that I don't go to in the city. We don't have that stuff. And when we do, it takes about 3 months for it to get skanked out. So show me where your clean Chili's is. That's, I really want to get into that. That's usually how it goes. Coming up, Heather Sharon's going to join us, and there's so much to talk about. I was talking with Heather today, just prepping on what we should talk about, and there's like eight things. Because if you're a longtime listener to WGN, when we were doing the download, and we're going to do this again coming up after the Sox season, but we would have the Daily Line on. Mike Fouché would come on, and we would talk, and Heather Sharon and A.D. Quigg. And Heather has agreed she's going to come back on, and we're going to do weekly check-ins on what's happening in Chicago and Illinois politics, because there's so many different stories that are happening. And I don't know if it's because it's a new mayor, maybe a new governor, but it just seems like it's rapid fire right now. Every single big-ticket item is being discussed this week. It's amazing to think about that. And we were talking with Anna in the crosstalk that all three unions, whether police, fire, and teacher, are all, they're getting tense at the same time. I'm just afraid that the mayor is going to be in these negotiations with teachers and be like, so you need overtime and you're going to catch the perps. I'm sorry. You're going to, <there's, laughs> so you need more hoses. What do you need? No, that's the other one. Oh, gosh. Ah. But there's so many negotiations going on with these three different unions, and it's starting to get a little testy out in public. So we'll talk with Heather Sharon about that and about this city budget hole that, you know, more and more we're hearing of creative ideas that all end in tax. So, there was this the big speech that the mayor gave about we're really going to have to come up with creative solutions as together as a community. And you're like, yeah, but at the end of the day, my guess is the creative solution is, you know, tax the people who live here. We've heard about a congestion tax, which I thought was very strange to be announced on stage with Uber. Is when Uber Freight and the mayor was there. And if you're anywhere downtown, you know who's causing the congestion. I mean, rideshare has a big part of that. And so it's kind of funny to be on stage talking about congestion tax when the Uber guys behind them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Out of curiosity, just an idea. Why not adopt some new regulations that say to delivery drivers,
mm-hmm.
if you have the option of turning a corner and finding a place to park where you're not blocking a lane of traffic on a two-lane street, etc., and you choose to park and block the two-lane street anyway,
yeah, you go to jail.
We double the ticket.
Oh, we double the ticket. Sorry, I thought you were going there. 6 months in county.
No, I don't. No, but I mean, there are just times when it's like, okay, find a parking space. If you got to walk,
No, I hear.
You got a cart? I mean, come on.
Well, the congestion tax is going to be about, it's all going to be about commute. It's going to be a commuter tax.
Oh, of course.
Come downtown. The other tax they're talking about, and this really came from, I forgot who it was, labor and civic minded organizations saying that anyone making over $100,000 in the city of Chicago should be slapped with a 3.5% tax, call it a, you know, like a rich tax. But the concept being that that would be a city income tax for anyone who makes over six figures. That's an idea that's kind of been thrown out. That's not from the mayor's office. That's from think tanks. But I think it should. I'd hate to see taxes. I'd rather see, and I know that we get crazy on tickets and penalties. You know, instead of like speeding, which is so boring, or red light, running red lights, or turning on red. No, I think that there are many ways to make money in this town. Little things that we take, like for instance, if you're a owner
making a turn, knowing full well you can't complete the turn, just put a bunch of ticket writers on Michigan Avenue from what, Ohio Street all the way up to the drive.
Yeah.
Okay. The money they could make in one day would be stunning.
Beyond moving violations, I'm saying like. You know, if you have one of those inflatable rafts that connects the four boats, so you can have a big party on,
yeah,
it's $250, right? Like that. I'm just saying, little things like that. Little things like that. If you have an Irish restaurant or bar that is an authentic Irish bar that was opened after 2010, that's a $500.
Why?
Because, you know, the idea that it's an old-timey Irish bar and you open it up now, you're faking it. It's not old, right?
There's a bar right by me. It was called the Norse, and it was like a good beer bar right up on Clark Street in Rogers Park. They rebranded it to Gracie O'Malley's. Yes.
And then they act like it's been there forever, like, established 2012. No, that's a $500 fine. No, you can't do that. How about bicyclists? Which I still think, and I know people get mad at me about this, but I think that there should be a license for bikes. Not unlike we do with, like we have to get a city sticker and our license plate. I think they should do the same with bikes. But I think if you roll up one pant leg when you're riding your bike, if you're that guy, it's $100, man.
No. I used to ride a bike all the time.
Did you roll up your leg?
Yes.
That's $75 right there.
No.
Just because I know
there's
you, David.
A reason.
Just because I know
no,
you.
No, but there's a reason for rolling the leg
dumb.
Up.
It looks dumb.
No, forget that. It would always be the right leg for the obvious reason. That's the side the chain is on.
Yeah, that just seems like a show-off thing.
It's not a show-off thing at all. It's called not having your pants chewed up by the chain.
I think that if
there's a method to the madness.
But you know what? If you were a true bike rider, you'd take that chewed up leg. And you'd be like, this is a point of honor. This is a point. So the idea you're rolling it up, I just think you're being pretentious. $75.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. Heather Sharon will come on and we'll get serious.
Why don't we start taxing bald guys?
No, see.
Who aren't bald naturally.
$150 for guys that who are bald who want to make it seem like, nah, I just shaved my head. No, you know,
in a direction I was not planning to go in.
$150 for the guy who's like, no, I'm not bald. This is a choice. This is a cool look. Brian Urlacher look. Thanks, David. Lots of great ideas coming in. 312-981-7200. If it's not going to be a congestion tax or a 1% tax, six-figure tax, what's it going to be? Let's see what we got here. Someone said chain guard. 815 said, you know, that's the idea here. We're talking about the pant leg. And I said, yeah, chain guard is like a muffler. So if you take that chain guard off, you're not street legal. Right? So that's a $50 fine. Right there. Also, 847 says, what about taxing dibs? in the wintertime. $25 a folding chair, right? And 2x4s, $75. Heather Sharon joins us now from The Daily Line. She's the managing editor of this, The Daily Line, a great publication. Such a great newsletter you should check out every morning that really gets you up to speed on what's happening at City Hall, also in Springfield and Cook County. And she joins us here on Extension 720. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Justin, and your check is in the mail. I appreciate that plug.
It is. That's the first thing I read every morning. And I will say, we're talking a lot tonight just about some of the things, some of the solutions that the mayor asked us to come up with for filling this budget hole. And, you know, I was thinking of some. I have another one to throw out. A tax on small plates.
Oh.
So if there's a restaurant that does small plates, and it's a $50 tax for every small plate, and then it's on the restaurant. And if the waitress comes up and says, "Have you ever dined here before, or have you ever had small plates? Let me explain small plates." That's $75 fine as well. What do you think?
I think that the West Loop would revolt.
We get so much money from the West Loop right there, Heather. We're kind of joking around tonight, but this is looking at the. The budget, that hole that is $838 million that needs to somehow be filled in the next, or ideas in the next 3 months. Before we get there, how did we get to this moment when you look at last year and the mayor, last Mayor Emanuel saying, you know what, oh my gosh, we are almost close to zero on this, net zero. How did we get to $838 million for the next year?
One word, pensions. That's essentially a third of the $838 million shortfall. And the issue is that several years ago, the state law changed to require the city to basically boost its payments to its four pension funds in order to reach a 90% funding level.
Yeah, right.
That is sort of the bill that's coming due now. And if it wasn't for that, the city would be still in not great shape, but you wouldn't be hearing people like me tossing around words like crisis and unprecedented and, running around with our hair on fire, which it feels like a lot of people are doing right now.
Well, when you look at it, and Lawrence Massal tweeted out from the Civic Federation just a snapshot, a graph from the last 15 years of budget deficits. And you see the numbers. I think it was 2011, right after the economic downturn, that something like $400 or $500 million was the highest it's been. It blows it out of the water, and we're not even looking at next year and the year after. I mean, there is something to be said about it being unprecedented and in uncharted waters for the city of Chicago.
Absolutely, and I should say, in Rahm Emanuel's defense, although he certainly does not need little old me defending him, the way that Lori Lightfoot calculated the budget deficit is different than Rahm Emanuel had been doing it. And she says it's a more accurate, complete look, but last year's budget deficit didn't look really at the pension debt. So that's the bill that's coming due this year. And Rahm Emanuel basically said, well, we don't have to pay it this year, so I'm not going to worry about it this year. And now we're in the position that we're in. So that graph, and Lawrence Massal is always 100% on point. It's just a little bit misleading because it's a little bit apples and oranges in the way that things were calculated. And that, I think, is part of the problem because, lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? You can sort of not juke the stats, but sort of shape things. And let's not forget that Mayor Lightfoot is, just coming into office, and it's relatively not all that uncommon for new mayors or new presidents or new governors to come into office and say, whoa, I found some really terrible stuff nobody told me about.
Right.
In an attempt to sort of maybe give themselves a little bit more playroom to, figure out what's going on.
And that makes a lot of sense when you look at Lawrence's graph and you see in 2011 that was the highest at 500 plus whatever million dollars, and then it went away. It may be the same thing that Mayor Emanuel, when he came into office, did the same thing, reshaped the numbers to give himself a little bit of cover to make tough decisions.
Correct. Now, the big issue facing Mayor Emanuel, of course, was that the city basically had to boost its contributions to the police and fire pension funds before the other two funds, which are for laborers and for municipal workers. So when you think back at 2015, and I think you and I talked about this a little bit, that you know, historic property tax increase, that was really geared to get the fire and police pension funds on track. Now we're sort of dealing with all four, and all four are ramping up significantly.
So you mentioned property taxes, and you know, now we're, you know, as the mayor in her primetime speech talked about, we have to come together and come up with creative solutions for this budget deficit. What should we make of some of these floated ideas, whether it be a congestion tax or a city income tax or any tax whatsoever?
Well, I think you've really got to put the potential solutions in two buckets. One bucket is solutions that the city council could enact by itself, and that includes things like a congestion tax or a property tax increase. The other bucket of potential solutions are things that the city council needs permission from the General Assembly to do, and that includes an income tax, that includes a sales tax on high-end luxury services, and that also includes a congestion tax. So what the city could do with sort of a congestion tax is to increase the ride-hailing fee on Uber and Lyft. So that would be sort of a quasi-congestion tax, because we all know that all of those cars are adding to the, you know, rush day, as Mayor Lightfoot said. So that's what they could do. But the city council's hands are really tied in a lot of ways in terms of how they can raise revenue. And Mayor Lightfoot has said...
Oh, I think we lost Heather there. We'll get her back on the line here. It's actually a perfect time because we can take a break. But, it's interesting because... you think about that. My next question, which we'll forego and continue the conversation when we get her back, is just, you know, the Springfield session, the veto session will be coming up here soon. I guess it would be in October. So there's going to be some questions of whether or not she can get that stuff through to Springfield. And if Springfield will have the appetite to bail out Chicago. So that'll be coming up. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get Heather back on the line since we've got to get to the break anyway. It's perfect timing. Heather, always is perfect timing. Phone goes out right when we need to take a break anyway. And we come back, we'll talk about the union negotiations and also some other things on the docket today. Federal oversight, CPS, when it comes to sexual misconduct and assault allegations. Timothy Evans is back. And the lawsuit to rescind tax subsidies for Lincoln Yards may not happen. So all that coming up here on Extension 720. So stay with us. Extension 720, rolling along here on 720 WGN. We got Heather Sherrone back on the line. She's the managing editor over at the Daily Line, which covers all things Chicago, county, state when it comes to politics. And you can sign up for their newsletter as well, which is great. Let's continue the conversation. We'll move on from the budget and talk about union negotiations. We both, whether it's the teacher negotiations or police negotiations or fire, it's all in the news right now. It just seems like a chaotic event or a lot of negotiations for the new mayor right now, Heather.
That's right. And it's important to keep in mind that when we were talking about the budget, we weren't even talking about pay raises that teachers are looking for, that police officers are looking for, and that firefighters are looking for. So that is what I like to call an unknown known that the city is going to have to figure out how to pay for and get those deals done. The teachers could go on strike as soon as October 7th. So that's probably the most pressing contract, but the police and the firefighters have been working without a contract for more than 2 years. Wow. At this point.
That's amazing. And is this something that you might see that Lori Lightfoot kicks the can down the road? If there's already been 2 years without a contract, can it be four? Can it be six? Is that something that we might see from the future politicians of Chicago?
It's hard to imagine it going much longer, but it's equally as hard to imagine figuring out a deal for the police union, which has been very critical of the mayor and her approach to police reform. And it's, you know, we talk about this as reporters in the City Hall press room sometime. We all can't imagine what a deal that would be acceptable to the Fraternal Order of Police and the City Council, which, of course, has moved significantly left since the last election.
Right.
What that agreement looks like, it boggles my mind. And if I had a crystal ball, that's the question I would ask.
You saw this week, you know, she's being public about some of this. Obviously with the teachers union, they're both talking about what's on the table, what's not, and come together. But you saw with the police being sort of frustrated and angry about overtime, and even going to the fire department and saying, or the fire union and saying, hey, you know, can we get some concessions, and not necessarily winning those concessions. concessions. So it doesn't seem like she has allies, even though some of these unions backed her for her campaign.
Absolutely. These are really tough, you know, life or death, you know, decisions. So one of the issues with the fire department is whether what level of staffing should be in every firehouse. And critics of the current deal, or I guess the last now expired deal, would say that there are too many firefighters on duty at any given time because the department just doesn't fight as many fires as it used to. And most of the calls it answers are calls for medical assistance. Mm. So the department really has to sort of, you know, perhaps change and enter this, you know, brand new modern era. But that's really difficult because you're talking about people's livelihoods. And, you know, you don't ever want to be in a situation where you don't have enough staff to respond to a catastrophe, especially with, you know, the threat of terrorism prominent in all of our minds with the anniversary of September 11th, right, just this year. So these are all decisions that have no easy answers, because if there had been easy answers, this would have gotten done 2 years ago. Mm. And now it just gets a little bit harder every single day.
Oof. All right, we got about five things to talk about in 5 minutes. Let's do a little rapid fire. Lots going on. CPS gets federal oversight when it comes to the Tribune's great piece on sexual misconduct and assault allegations. What does that entail? What does that mean to get federal oversight of CPS when it comes to monitoring sexual misconduct?
Well, it's very similar to the consent decree that the police department is under. And essentially, the federal government has laid out a series of requirements that the school district is going to have to meet, and it's going to have to change the way that it takes complaints in from students about sexual misconduct and how it investigates those.
Now, I was under the impression they did that already, that the CPS, right after that report, they're like, and Rahm Emanuel, they went on a whole, they were on the press blitz.
They sure did,
so,
yeah.
So why do we need the federal government if they fixed it?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and the federal government certainly implies that they didn't fix it. And we heard Mayor Lightfoot sort of look a little bit sideways at that, noting that, of course, Betsy DeVos is Trump's appointed education secretary, and she sort of suggested that, you know, maybe we shouldn't take their decision at face value, because, of course, Chicago has been in the president's crosshairs for, what is it, like a decade, 20 years, 25 years, something like that, yeah, at this point.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't think about that, but that does make a little bit of sense. Let's move on. Timothy Evans is back. This was a decision made. This is a strange, archaic way that they do this, but he's going to run the courts again. And it was a secret closed door meeting where they all said, "Hear ye," and they wore robes and there were candles. I guess, I don't know. I wasn't in there, but what happened today, and what does it mean that Timothy Evans is going to be running the courts again?
All of the Cook County judges, so this is people who decide everything from murder cases to traffic tickets to who marry people in the basement at City Hall, got together and they decided that Tim Evans would continue to be the chief judge, which he has been since 2001. So he gets another term in office, and it will be his eighth. That's a record. And he was able to convince people that he was the status quo was working. And of course, this has been an issue in recent weeks, and you and I have talked about this, that he's really led the push for bond reform, which Mayor Lightfoot has been really critical of and has basically accused him of contributing to Chicago's gun violence. Now, he said today that he had recently met with the mayor and they had a great conversation. So maybe that all is going to be resolved, but it's certainly an issue and one that his opponent tried to make hay out of.
Yeah, that's quite a political kingpin in Timothy Evans. He's been around forever.
Sure.
All right. Lawsuit to rescind tax subsidies for Lincoln Yards doesn't look like it's going to happen. This story, we could do an hour on this story, just that
easy.
It seemed like they were fudging the numbers to get the tax subsidy through in a rush, but it sounds like the judge today says this lawsuit may not have merit.
Well, I mean, state law says that if you're going to use tax increment financing, the property has to be blighted. The truck-sized loophole in that law is that blight means whatever the city decides that it means. And the judge basically said, look, I'm going to take a look at this argument. I'm going to make sure that the city follows the law. But if they made this agreement, I don't know that I have standing to undo the agreement. And what the groups are arguing is that essentially this was rushed through in the waning days of Mayor Rahm Emanuel's administration, and that this area isn't actually blighted. It doesn't need city money to be redeveloped because this is right along the Chicago River and it used to be a steel foundry. And the city's argument is, look, there's no infrastructure out there. There are no streets, there are no streetlights, there are no sidewalks. So essentially, the city would reimburse developer Sterling Bay for building all of that infrastructure, and the city says that without that, the deal won't, you know, it won't be redeveloped. And we should know sometime next week whether the judge is going to dismiss the case.
Yeah, it's an interesting read, and that's in the Daily Line as well. All right, and the final one, the alderman looked to be pushing through a new, which was a Mayor and Lightfoot initiative, to make investigations public. Now, obviously, that sounds like a great thing, and it's surprising to me that it wasn't, but we saw how that played out with the Laquan McDonald investigation.
That's right. So the city's inspector general's office has gotten dozens of requests from every news organization in Chicago for the detailed records of his investigation into what happened, and he has had to reject that because city law does not allow that to be released. And this would change that law, and basically it would give the city's top lawyer ability to sort of consult with the inspector general and say, look, this is a really serious case. It involves a death or a felony, and it's of great public interest. Would we cause any harm to an ongoing investigation if we release this information? And this law would allow him to say, yes, let's go ahead and putting it out. So that's great for you and I. Journalists love laws like this. However, there are big caveats to this. Essentially, if the investigation involves an employee who's covered by a union agreement that prohibits the release of any information about them, that won't happen. So this is going to be another flashpoint between the police union and the city.
All right. Ding, ding, ding. We did it. Heather Sharon, managing editor at the Daily Line. And I'm looking forward to having you start in October back, and we can continue to have these conversations, very important conversations. Heather, thanks
That's
for joining us. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago-born author Alex Poppy just published her first novel. It's called Moxie. It comes from a short story that Poppy wrote for her collection Girl World. The novel follows the main character, Jax. Jax is a former supermodel who, after a motorcycle bombing in Morocco, has her face permanently disfigured. Jax has to learn how to live her life now that beauty is not her calling card. The novel also takes on issues surrounding social justice and immigration. Poppy used her own experiences in the fashion industry to help with the story, as well as her life as an actor and an educator. Currently, the Lombard-born writer is teaching abroad. She is living in northern Iraq, teaching at American University of Iraq. She's back for a couple days, and we're excited to have Alex Poppy in studio tonight on Extension 720. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's get right to it. This is amazing. The ability for a writer to start with a short story and move that into a novel. How difficult is it to do that?
I can't speak for other writers because I don't know how they work, but I never know what the story is going to be. I'm not a writer that writes a ton and goes back and edits a ton. I go beat by beat and I edit every day. So the story kind of unfolded itself to me. I didn't really know the direction I wanted to take it in. There were two stories in that first collection I thought I would expand. Mm-hmm. I have a rape in the military story in that first collection, and I wanted to expand that, but I didn't know what that story was about yet. So then I revisited Jax because I could really hear her. I mean, it's so voice-driven. I don't think really all that much happens in the book, but it's very voice-driven. And I could hear her talking, and so I let her talk to me, and that's what followed. And then as I got interested in things, they found themselves in the story. So the Kalief Browder story was because I was listening to Democracy Now!, and the New Yorker had done a lot of great reporting on it. The urbexing was something I saw in the New York Times, and I thought, wow, that's so cool. I got to put it in. Immigration, obviously. Right. I was hunting around on the Half Kings website, and I saw the photography exhibit online. And I mean, my dad's an immigrant, and that resonated, so that became part of it.
As a writer, is that where you draw inspiration from, being an informed citizen, but also someone who is just paying attention to the world around you and the issues around you? You're able to look at those stories, those factual stories, and be able to make fiction out of them?
Yeah. I had a short story that started with a photograph I saw on Facebook of a friend of mine, a great friend of mine, when he was super young. And then I had read this article again in the Times about biogenetic engineering and how wealthier couples were purchasing the qualities they wanted in their children. And I thought, whoa, that's strange.
That's a story.
To do a lot of research, and it became my story family matter.
Back to the idea of writing a short story and then choosing to expand that story. What are the qualities you're looking for? You said it was easy for you to expand Jax's character or Jax's story. Was it because the character was more developed than others? Because you resonated more with the character? What was it about this particular story that said, this is going to be my first novel?
It was the voice. I have to hear the character. I have to hear the narrator. And if I can't hear it, it's very hard for me to write. I'm working on a coming-of-age novel where I use flamenco as an extended metaphor, and it's very lyrical. And I purposely have tried not to have this brash, aggressive, funny narrative voice because that's been a lot of my first two books. And as a result, I can't quite hear this narrator all the time, and it's a bit more difficult to write. So I could definitely hear the voice, mm-hmm. and I just let the voice speak to me.
Talk about Jax. This character is very nuanced. And to start the novel in a way that you almost are coming from a place of depression. Depression might not be the right word, but just she's very dark. In the way that she's approaching her life, and then it unfolds what happened to her, and you can understand why. But talk about this character. What do we need to know about Jax?
I like the descriptions of her being profane and poetic. I think they're both equally accurate. To me, I deliberately set out to craft a character that was unlikable. I wanted that challenge to see if I could make the audience and the reader root for this character and stay with them through the length of the novel. Then the qualities I gave her are the qualities we more often ascribe to men and that we give permission to men to have. Sexual promiscuity and just overall kind of bad behavior. And I wanted to make the point that it's not engendered, right? There's behavior that both genders equally employ or exhibit. But our society sort of excuses it, I believe, more with men than they do with women. So I wanted to give those qualities to a female. I've always been fascinated with this idea. I started as a financial analyst. So growing up, I was not very attractive. I grew up in, city of Chicago, outside Chicago, where the ideal of beauty was blonde, blue-eyed, small-featured, and, I have very Italian features. So I grew up, basically being told that I wasn't attractive, but I was really smart. And then I became an actor, and that whole industry is so looks-focused. Mm-hmm. And then I, worked for a designer, could see what was happening with the models. And I thought, well, what happens to women who the only way they've known themselves is from what they look like? That's all their identity is anchored in. And then I feel like American culture isn't very kind to women in my demographic. So over 50, people who have consciously not married or had children, the society doesn't really know what to do with us or where to put us. Whereas other cultures, sometimes women are more included in the fabric of society at all ages. Sometimes they're entirely discluded. But for me, I wanted to explore what that's like, and I wanted it to be immediate and sudden. So that's the accident. That's why her face is half destroyed.
It's really interesting, too, because there is this wrestling with how she thinks people are going to perceive her.
Yeah.
It almost becomes almost the first thought that she has. And almost every time she meets somebody, whether it's somebody that she's interested in or says something to her on the street or anything like that. And there seems to be this preoccupation around beauty. And this beautiful passage about whether or not she was happy when she was a model and she was doing all these things, a swimsuit cover, or whether she was in a Victoria's Secret ad. She didn't know that she was happy or not. And she looked back fondly on those memories, but she also didn't know if she was happy at that time.
I think part of that is she's confusing convenience with happiness. I also crafted her with a deliberate lack of agency, and I used sentence structure to communicate that. I think the sentence structure works on a subliminal level. I don't think people realize that's what I'm doing. They just notice it. So the first two-thirds of the novel, Jax almost never uses the I. They're all sentence fragments because she doesn't have agency for her actions. And as she comes to terms with the horrible thing that she feels that she's done and sort of has a little bit of a resolution, she starts having her eyes in her sentences and speaks in more complete sentences.
That's interesting.
So I think when she thinks, oh, was I happy? It was more that it was convenient because somebody was telling her what to do. She had a handler always organizing things for her. She didn't have to think.
She didn't have to think about not being a model. I mean, that a lot of it is it obviously seems to be like a metaphor or a story about what a lot of people, when their business is on looks, whether you're an actor or a model or anything like that, and like you said, they sort of phase out in what society considers them to be in that demographic, what do they do with their lives? In this case, it was thrusted upon her because of a bombing. Mm-hmm. And a disfigurement to her face. But that's the concept of being, having to figure out what to do next when you're all you were just in it.
John Burnside has this great quote in one of his short stories. The end of the story is the character's like, I must not want anything, so therefore I must be happy. So this absence of desire, is this, does it equal being happy? And I think that that happens with our lives. We get into routine and maybe aren't making our choices, but allowing, you know, what you should do. You should get married. You should have a house. You should have children. Those things kind of dictate the way our lives flow. And then we say, well, okay, yeah, I must have had a good life. I must be happy. But has there been agency in any of those choices?
Alex Poppy is my guest. She's the author of the novel Moxie, her first one. She grew up here in Lombard, Illinois, and she's now teaching in Iraq. And I want to talk about that.
Sure.
We'll take a quick break and we'll come back here on Extension 720. So stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My my guest, author Alex Poppy. Her first novel, Moxie, is out now. As I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, you grew up in the area, in Lombard, and mm-hmm. you also now are teaching abroad. I want to get into that because, you know, teaching at a university in Iraq, in northern Iraq, with the kids that you have as well, to think that this is the generation that of Iraqi children who are now or were part of the invasion.
Yeah.
And that's something I don't think we think about. We think about how things, years move on, but we don't think about how it affected the people that live there. And I want to ask you about that as someone who has direct involvement with these students and to see what they've had to live through for the last 15 years. What's your takeaway? Do you feel that their story's being told?
I don't really feel like their story is being told. I've written a couple of nonfiction pieces about students who have let me interview them at length. But our population is a majority Kurdish, so their parents have lived through Anfal. I have a lot of Yazidi kids that survived the genocide in Sinjar, which is very recent and very raw. I have kids from Mosul who had to figure out how to survive through ISIS. And I have kids from the south who were 10, 11, 12, 13 during the 2003 invasion and remember what it was like when coalition forces came in through their houses and did those sweeps late at night. And sometimes they were very friendly and they took their gloves off and shook a father's hand. And sometimes they put all the men in the courtyard and beat them. And I'm always amazed when my students just don't categorically hate Americans. I have this kid. He's just amazing. He's from Tikrit. You know, he had two uncles that were in Abu Ghraib. You know, we did that. And he can remember another time where they were coming to search the house and his uncle or cousin's wife was stuffing the gold in her pockets. And one of the coalition forces soldiers was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And he grabbed her in a way that's very offensive for the local culture. And so her husband came running up and they just shot him and killed him in front of everyone. And those are their experiences that they've had and witnessed in very formulative years. And so that they can, that they have the ability to divorce a culture or a people from the foreign policy in the government of a country is remarkable to me. That they don't hate Americans, that they don't think we do want to just go in and steal the oil, no matter how many times Trump has said that since his inauguration, is remarkable to me. And it's the only thing that really gives me hope that they will find peace for themselves without it being imposed from a foreign power.
Is it difficult to be in the position you're in as a teacher without that shared experience, to be someone from the Midwest and the United States of America who goes to northern Iraq and has to not deal, but to connect with kids who have come from such disparate backgrounds?
I worked in the West Bank prior, so...
Or even in that experience as well, yeah.
So that experience was informative, and I've worked in other countries which are former war zones or, you know, places where women especially are trafficked or they're transit countries. So it's around. In that sense, I think you can go to any poorer part of the United States and see students that are struggling against odds that maybe if you've grown up in a middle-class family, you're not aware of. Like, it takes a certain income level to be able to provide your kids PSAT classes, mm-hmm. sophomore, junior year. I mean, all these things that we sort of take for granted if we've grown up in a middle-class living.
I have a 12-year-old. They're already talking about pre-classes for standardized testing to get into high school.
Right.
I mean, you get to a certain point where it's not even the suggestion is I have to go pay private lessons for him to get ready for that test.
Exactly. And if you don't have the money for it, that's a competitive advantage. So you have kids that perhaps are growing up in poorer neighborhoods, and they're using the same parts of their brain just for survival. But we don't always recognize that the development of those cognitive skills, I mean, they're actually problem solving as opposed to just memorizing and repeating and studying scholastically. So I don't think you need to go to somewhere as extreme as Northern Iraq, which is relatively safe right now and therefore not extreme, to see that kind of disadvantage to some people. I mean, we have it here.
When you are able to go back and forth to be able to live and teach in Northern Iraq and come back to Chicago, when you come back to Chicago, are we informed? Do we understand what's happening?
I would say not as much as I'd like generally people to be. The first question I get is, do you feel safe? So I was just in Naples and I was very violently and brutally mugged. That would never, ever, ever happen in Northern Iraq. It just wouldn't. Culturally, it wouldn't happen because it's much more community oriented, and because of Islam rooted in culture as well as in religion, you would never treat a stranger that way because you don't know if that stranger is Allah. The students there, students leave stuff everywhere and it always gets returned. So like you don't have theft, you don't have violence like that. I don't know how much you want to know about Kurdish politics, but there are two major political parties in the KRG in the northern region of Iraq. And one of the political parties' leaders was accused of siphoning oil from the south for a long time and stealing a lot of money. And so the government in Baghdad cut off the payments for Iraq for its budget, which is 17% of the national budget. So all public service employees weren't paid full salaries for 4 years. My city, the opposition political party city, is 65% public service employees. I can't imagine.
Can you imagine
here when people wouldn't get paid or if they didn't get paid for that long? And it did break public school education. So high school went from, you know, half time to like a couple days a week to sometimes they didn't start the school year till mid-December and they didn't call the school year. They counted it. And then it stopped again in March. So the kids just didn't have contact hours.
Right.
You're not just losing the information, but you're losing the ability to sit and take in information. And yet they still managed to get it together and continue. At one point, when these public service employees weren't being paid, the police went on strike. The police went on strike in any major United States city. I would imagine there would be tons of looting, as you've seen when you have different catastrophes in cities and there's no power. It doesn't happen there. So there are differences, and I think that those are the things you don't realize when you hear about Iraq. And there are other issues. As being a foreign woman is a real drag. The patriarchy there is offensive. It's very limiting how I conduct my personal life outside of the university, just in terms of mobility, just the ability to walk at 6:30 at night to go run my errands after my work. I'm going to be followed in a car. Someone's going to try to grab me out a window. They're going to drive backwards and call out. And that's super annoying, but I never feel like my life is at stake.
You know, for you to be a novelist, a writer, to have had a life and, like you mentioned, a financial analyst, to be an actor, to work for a designer, I'm trying to figure out what got you to Northern Iraq. What is it about your temperament, about who you are, that for all the things that you have done in your life and the success that you've had, that this calling attracted you?
It was equal parts desperation and curiosity. I had come back to the United States in 2010, and I was not gainfully employed. I had come from Ukraine. And then I met the writer Jerry Van Dyke, who's written Captive. He was kidnapped by the Taliban and wrote a book about it. And then he went back and wrote a book called The Trade. He wanted the labyrinth of political kidnapping. He wanted to know how he had been freed. And he became a mentor, and he definitely encouraged me to go and give it a try. And I didn't start writing till 2010. So that part of my journey kind of happened at the same time, and I found Iraq to be very inspiring in a way because the people you meet are crazy. I can remember sitting in this nightclub with the Minister of Christian Affairs and his cousin. And this guy comes in and they tell me that he's a hitman for this very prominent political family. And he looks like he's just walked off the set of The Sopranos. And there's like a gun check sign, as there are everywhere. And he like flashes open his double-breasted suit coat and there's a gun in each pocket. So he's definitely got Waster political clout that he can bring his guns in. And the kicker is, he's in law school. He's in his third year of law school.
You need to be.
Can't make it up.
You need to be holding if you want to become a lawyer. Maybe that's the story. It seems like your life's about journeys, And you have, you know, you've intimated in a way all the different places you've been in this life, and you continue to tell those stories. How important is having this kind of life where you're spread out and you're doing different things different ways to being a writer?
I'm definitely inspired by place. Moxie was my love letter to New York. I lived there for such a long time. It feels like home, and I missed it very much. I was living in Leipzig when I started it, and then I, you know, finished it in northern Iraq. So it's, I came from the writer's studio. That's where I learned how to write. A great program. I highly recommend it. It's in New York, but they have online classes. They really taught me how to write, and they're big about the persona narrator, and they're also big about the emotional connection to your material. So for me, it's about having a connection to what I'm writing. You can see I have both sides of my face intact, but there is an emotional truth. I understand what it's like to be called ugly or to be considered ugly, and I can write from that emotional truth. So sometimes that truth comes from experience, and sometimes it comes from place, and sometimes it comes from empathy. And I think empathy is necessary to be a writer. So the rape in the military story, for people who don't know that, if you are raped by a military person or you're in the military, you don't get the usual system of justice. You don't make a complaint and it's investigated. You have to go through a chain of command that exists in the military, and often the person who is your perpetrator is your commanding officer, yeah, superior, or in your right. chain of command. And so they can decide if the case will even be adjudicated or investigated. And at times they've even overturned convictions within the military. It's very much a protect your own. Kirsten Gillibrand has tried to get an amendment to change this, to put it in a separate tribunal, because it exists already in the military, but has been unsuccessful. And this, no offense, gentlemen, white boys culture, protect your own, is so prevalent in places like the military and a lot of NGOs. And it allows for gender-based violence to continue. And so that is something that's very difficult for me as a female who has dealt with enough sexual misconduct in the workplace, as a business analyst, as a person teaching abroad, as an actor, that I have this emotional connection, and I want to write about it. I want to fictionalize it. I feel like fiction should represent accurately the worlds we live in. But at the same time, it's not rooted in place. It's not always place, but it's more this emotional right. connection.
The novel is called Moxie. It's Alex Poppy's first novel, and it's out now. Alex, who is from Lombard, but now lives in northern Iraq, teaches American University of Iraq. Thank you so much for coming in. I know you did a short time to be back home, but then you're out and all over the world again. Alex, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Back to Justin Kaufman and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
It is Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Coming up, John Schmidt's going to be back. I'm loving this series. They're great. And you know, we've talked about this a lot, that, you know, because Extension 720 continues to be preempted by White Sox baseball, it gives Pete and I a chance to get out in the city and the surrounding area and bring stories to life by actually going to the places as opposed to just talking about it in talk show format. So we did that. We went out with John Schmidt, and we're doing it again next week. But it was such a hot day just a couple weeks ago, where we went to a few different places around the city. We just hopped in my car and just got to the spot. No double parking. We got this. We legally parked, and then went to the different places and had these conversations about the hidden Chicago landmarks, which are featured in his new book. John Schmidt, great Chicago historian, former high school teacher. He's written a ton of books, but his latest is Hidden Chicago Landmarks. And last week we kicked it off. We did the Cow Path, which was really where we got the idea, which was to focus on this book. And we had done the Monroe Cow Path, the Cow Path and the Loop. And then we said, you know what? This is such a great idea. Every single chapter, because this book is, I don't know, it's 200 some odd pages. And there's probably 100 and plus places, maybe a little less. Everything from Mahalia Jackson's home to Chicago's oldest public monument to Chicago's shortest street to Hillary Clinton's home, to what we're talking about tonight, Clarence Wagner's Bridge,
But we did last week, we started off with the Balbo Column, which is a great story because that was one where, oh boy. It was funny because it says it's just east of Soldier Field. It's between Burnham Harbor and Soldier Field. It's in there. That's where it's at. And it was like, I felt like we were Indiana Jones. We're like in there trying to find this relic. And when you come up on the Balbo Column, it really does look like a relic. I mean, there's nothing that says go this way. There's a ton of signs, you know, because that's the Gold Star Memorial Park, which is beautiful, and the plaque for all the fallen police officers and the park there. They've done a great job there. And they'll have signs to go this way. And if you want to go to the Harbor, if you want to go to the Adler, if you want to go to Soldier Field, you want to go to parking, you want to do anything, there's a sign for it. Balbo Column? No, no sign. You don't need a sign. Go walk in there by those bushes. And then you find it. And it's really amazing to see the history of it. It was a gift given to the city of Chicago during the World's Fair, right after the World's Fair, from Benito Mussolini.
Yeah, that was a hike.
Uh-huh. Because we parked over by the Adler.
Yeah. It was hot. And I was like, where is this thing?
Yeah.
Is he making it up?
I don't think John knew where it was. He didn't. He's just like, it's this way. I know it's over here. Yes. And it's so true. Yeah. When you get there, you realize why. There's no fanfare for it. And I don't know if there should be. You know, it's a fascist dictator's gift to the city of Chicago. It's so obvious that it's history. They can't really get rid of it. I know the Italian-American community doesn't want it to change Balbo Street. You know, they want to, you know, there's been a push to rename it because it was General Balbo, who was an airman, and he served Benito Mussolini. And Mussolini, they came over in the World's Fair, and they brought all these planes over, and it was amazing, and they had such a good time. And Mussolini, this was before World War II, was like, you know what, I love this city. This is a great partnership. And they get fascism. They get it. They get it, and I'm going to give them a column. And on the right, it's Italian writing, and it says, on the seventh year of the fascist dictator, not dictator, fascism, long live fascism, something like that. It's pretty crazy. Anyway, today we talk a little bit about Chicago politics and a former political kingpin by the name of Clarence Wagner. And they renamed the bridge, and it's funny because there's a lot to be landmarked in this area. It's right, the bridge is right over the Chicago River, right before the old post office, which of course has been in the news because Uber is going to take over, and that's where they're going to do the freight division out of. And just to the east used to be the Congress Parkway, which is now renamed Ida B. Wells. So there's been a lot of fanfare and landmark and history that has gone into that area, and everyone just keeps forgetting about the bridge, which is actually the Clarence Wagner Memorial Bridge. So we'll talk to John Schmidt about why that bridge is there, why it's the Memorial Bridge, and who Clarence Wagner is all the way down. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. How great, right? And then next week's, I'm very excited about next week's too, I think we'll do this one next week, is the Logan's Tomb. You know, there's Logan Square, there's General Logan, and this weird rivalry we had. And I think you can feel the roots of a rivalry with New York City. But it was a real thing in the late 19th century after the Civil War when General Grant, who, of course, you can go down to Springfield into the old Capitol building and see impersonators, you know, doing their best General Grant to, you know, seventh graders, sixth graders. And, you know, like he is well known to be an Illinois prodigal son, right? You know, he's buried in New York City. And it's sort of like, hey, what? What? And so there was a little back and forth where they were like, yeah, we want a prominent officer. We'll take Logan. And then they created all this. They spent tons and tons of money to do this big tomb in Grant Park. It's all in John's book. And what came out of it, it's just interesting about when there's rivalries at stake. and what happened and what's actually in Logan's tomb. That conversation too.
It's like when you're driving through Indiana and they say, like, Lincoln lived here too, you know, like everybody stakes a claim to Abe Lincoln.
Right.
Like, no, he's ours, land of Lincoln.
Yeah, we claimed him first. He was in a log cabin, and then he said, I'm never coming back. That's the best part about the Lincoln story. There's a little, and I'm not a historian. I'm sure people text in saying, that's not accurate, Justin, and I understand that. My dad is probably listening saying, I've read the 1,600 biographies of Abraham Lincoln. But the vibe I get is that he was a lawyer, whatever he was, at a certain point, and he just went, all right, enough of Illinois. Like his little thing, yeah. Like, I'm going to get on this canoe, I'm going to get on this raft, and I'm gone. And then the next thing, he becomes president, the whole thing, and he's like, I ain't coming back. So I'd love to read the biography where he's like, boy bye to the state of Illinois. He was like every, people get all upset about people leaving the state of Illinois.
He moved to Nashville.
Yeah.
He moved to Nashville.
He didn't like the gas prices here. They taxed and spend Democrats up. And you know what? I'm out of here. I'm going to Washington. I'm never going back. And we're like, well, he never left. He kind of did. I don't want to throw water on it, but. He did leave. He's the original, all the celebrities that start here and then they go to L.A. or New York. Lincoln was the original. He's like, this state's not big enough for me. I got what I need to get out of here. I got to go to the coasts where the action's at. He never came back. At least Kanye came back. I don't remember Lincoln doing the Sunday service. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. John Schmidt. And I want to talk. We'll take a break. We'll talk about the Walk of Fame coming up here. Extension 720. Stay with us. Tomorrow's a big day here at WGN. I'm excited. Always good, right? Tune in this Friday, so that'd be tomorrow, right? Tomorrow, September 13th at 10 a.m. for the WGN Walk of Fame ceremony with Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder as your masters of ceremony. We'll honor four inductees who are all native Chicagoans, two present-day voices, John Williams and Andrea Darlis, a man who hosted a show for 60 consecutive years, a 10-pin tattler, Sam Weinstein. How great is that? So much, it's crazy to me because, and I want to get into John and Andrea, who I know, and I never knew Sam, but it's just amazing to me because of all of this that Duffy puts together, the promos and the people, and just about how bowling in general and broadcasts of bowling, a lot of it comes from Sam. I mean, a lot of the stuff that even was transferred to television came from Sam and putting a focus on bowling. That's crazy. And behind-the-scenes staff member who marks 52 years with the station this October, Marlene Wells. How about that? Marlene is a treasure, and she's somebody who is always very helpful and a big presence. And she's whenever we go out on remotes, we do that a lot. Marlene is there, and she's handling not just the setup, but she's handling making sure that everybody's comfortable at talent, making sure that the everyone who's there is it's a marvel to watch. She also takes a lot of pictures with the iPad. It's always a strong move. I told her today. I said, I'm looking forward to your speech. So I said, you know, the drill is that it's 1 minute for every year you've been at the station. So she's got to do 52 minute speech. She says she's not doing a speech. I said, no, that's unacceptable.
You do know that what Marlene wants is what Marlene will get.
The best part is that the invite that I got, the paperless invite that's a, you open up and whatever, is from Marlene.
Yeah.
And the follow-up, the subsequent follow-up, because I'm not good at that stuff, saying, did you open that? Did you RSVP? Is from Marlene.
She's hassling you.
To Marlene's party.
On her induction day.
52-minute speech. That's what she has to do. She says she's not doing it.
She's not doing anything?
She says she'll answer questions if someone asks questions. So Bill and Wendy are going to ask questions. But I want a speech. I want a straight-up speech.
Yeah.
I want page turns. I'll ask Marlene. I'll email Marlene to see if Marlene can get a teleprompter.
Can anybody ask questions, or are just Bill and Wendy?
No,
I don't think
it's a town hall.
No.
You want it to be a town hall? You in the back, on the right. You got a question for Marlene? No, Bill and Wendy, the usual format is they'll do a great produced introduction. She'll make some sort of statement, and then I think that Bill and Wendy will do like an interview or Q&A kind of thing. They used to do, this would be the first year, because they used to do it at the Pioneer Square, or Pioneer Square, is that what it's called?
Pioneer Court.
Court. Sorry, not a square, it's a court. You know, where they set up all the weird religion books that you want to, you might want to buy on Michigan Avenue. That's what I know Pioneer Court for. No, thanks. I'm okay. Thank you. I don't need my shoes shined, and I don't need to this religious book or a series of books that you're trying to sell me, or a new online diet plan, whatever you're hawking over there in front of the Trib Tower. But that's where we would do it. We put up the stage, and there's just amazing memories of everyone from the GN family coming together and being able to do that. And like I said, you know, it's been a couple of years since we've done this. And, you know, it's always great because so many, you know, people who have been a part of the WGN family come out. And I'm not sure, because it used to be outside. You know, that was the kind of thing. It's and I'm not sure. Is it? Do you know this? I guess it is. It says this is, you could tune in.
Yeah, they broadcast it live.
No, I know. But if I am a fan of WGN and Marlene and I want to come down to watch the ceremony, can I do that? Or is it an invite? Have we changed it up to a more invite only?
Don't know.
Change of the scenarios, the scenery and things.
I have no idea.
Anyway, Marlene's gonna be awesome. That's the highlight. And I want to say that it's so great for Andrea Darlis and John Williams, both who have been just professional, just unbelievable voices for this radio station. King John, to hear the promo that Duff's running from 1997. He was an intern for Wally Phillips. And for him to be able to be at the level he's at and continue to do a talk show from his mind about what's happening in this Chicago area since 1997, it's remarkable. It's remarkable. He doesn't get preempted. I get preempted all the time. It's going to take a while for me to catch up to a John Williams level of professionalism because he does every day. And it's not, and it's no takeaway to the other programs that have been around, but which are ensemble driven, that may have, that may be more humorous or, you know, kind of like this is a drive time type programming. And those are great. And John is a substantive program who wants to dig into something. He'll take an hour or a half hour or whatever to do. And he's doing it every single day. It's crazy. Andrea Darlis, I heard today in the hallway, they were trying to, I think it was just sort of fact check. Her being one of the first, if not the first, woman to anchor the morning news in Chicago, WGN in Chicago. So that's something on radio. And, you know, she's just, when she comes into the studio and she comes into the station, she's just, she lights it up. And she has been another person to both Pete and I, she has been such a supportive person, even when we first started texting us and emailing, and same with John, but just saying, you know, they like the show and they want to, you know, encourage us to continue to do things. And Andrea has just been, you know, sharing the microphone with her and hosting shows with her, but also, you know, being on after her show, Andrea and the reporters on Monday nights. It's a real honor to share a studio with her, but it's also an honor for her to be recognized in this way. She has meant a lot to a lot of different people and a lot of different listeners here at the station. So it's a really proud moment, and she deserves it. And it's great. I know that, you know, you get this kind of, you'll hear the kind of haters or, oh, this is GN just doing an infomercial for themselves, but it's not. I mean, WGN, you know, means a lot to Chicago and Chicago listeners. These people have been a part of that. You know, just Sam Weinstein just talking about how his complete impression on the world of bowl media surrounding the sport of bowling is unprecedented. I mean, it's unprecedented. You just listen to Duff's promo. And then the same with, you know, John and Andre do, and of course Marlene, who deserves this more than anything. They did a thing a couple of, I think it was a year ago, that they said, hey, do you have any suggestions on who should be nominated? I want to go on record that I nominated Marlene. Right? But I'm not the only one. I'm sure like 600 people here at the station were like, Marlene, Marlene, Marlene. But that was a person I was like, yeah, right on. She deserves it. She has been at this radio station for 52 years. Like I said, is going to give the best 52-minute speech tomorrow.
Who says you can't retire after one job in your life?
Yeah. She's seen a lot here.
Yeah.
So, okay, so to be following the Walk of Fame ceremony, there's going to be an hour-long special on L.A. focusing on at 11 a.m., focusing on the fun and conversations we've had for the past 95 years. So tune in tomorrow, 10 a.m., for a Walk of Fame ceremony, followed by the 95 Years of Chicago Conversation special. You can learn more about this year's inductees at WGNradio.com/Walk of Fame. Looking forward to that tomorrow. I got to figure out what I'm going to wear. It's always, the best of the best come out. You got to put your best on. Not necessarily a suit. I don't know if I'm going to go suit. But I got to figure it out.
They're taking photos of you as well.
They are.
Show photo.
Lots of photos.
We don't need a show photo. We got plenty of show photos.
By the way, they said on Cochrane it's invite only.
Oh, they did?
Since they moved it inside.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
So don't come
exclusive.
Downtown if you...
Don't you dare. If you should walk...
Marlene didn't email you a ticket, don't come.
Marlene's going to be doing the speech and bouncing from the stage. You're going to be like, no, you cannot be here. That person in the back, and I see your credentials. It's been a great career here at WGN. She's going to do both parts. Thanks, David. Station 720 with you till 10 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9:30, Chris Jones from the Chicago Tribune will be here. I was hesitant to promote it because Chris is coming from an actual theater performance, but he just messaged us and said, hey, I'm on my way. So Chris will be here to talk fall theater. I love when Chris is here. He just put out a great piece about some of the really spectacular stuff that's coming through town this fall in Chicago theater. So we'll have that. It still is the year of Chicago theater, by the way. The Department of Cultural Affairs called it that. And so we'll call it that too, right? Chris Jones coming up. 9:30. Well, who doesn't love Chicago history? And as this city thrives and builds, it also tears down and forgets. And sometimes all that's left is a random sign or a placard, and in some cases, nothing at all. Tonight, we continue our new series, which we're calling Hidden Chicago Landmarks. In this series, we bring to life the stories in historian John Schmidt's new book of the same name. We head out to the various sites with John to talk about the significance and the history. Tonight, let's talk about a bridge. It's not a big bridge, nor really a famous bridge. It's a bridge that does just that, bridging Ida B. Wells Drive to the Eisenhower. But as everyone pays attention to the old post office or renaming Congress Parkway, we forget about the Clarence Wagner Memorial Bridge, a forgotten hidden landmark that pays tribute to a political kingpin. Let's go. We're standing at D'Angelo Park, which is a park right near the old Congress, now Ida B. Wells ramp that heads over the old post office and onto 290 with John Schmidt, of course, our Chicago historian, our regular Chicago historian for our regular series here. All right, so what's so specific and historic about this spot?
A lot of people today know the intersection, the old spaghetti bowl, the Chicago Circle was a few years ago named after Jane Byrne. And that's kind of entered into common usage in Chicago on the traffic reports
right.
But a lot of people don't know this bridge over here, over the Chicago River, is actually called the Clarence Wagner Memorial Bridge. And that's a forgotten bit of Chicago political history.
Yeah, because everyone knows this spot just because it's right where you go under the old post office.
Yeah.
But the bridge right before over the river, yeah, I would think that was just called Ida B. Wells or 290 if you're lazy.
No, it's left over. Clarence Wagner was one of these forgotten politicians. I first heard about him from my grandpa Price. He was a precinct captain, so he used to tell tales about politics. But I really found out about him in 1970s when Royko's book and so on about Richard J. Daley came out. Clarence Wagner might have been the mayor of Chicago instead of Richard J. Daley if things had broken differently.
Wow.
He was a Southside alderman. He was half Irish, and his father was German. But he was part of the Southside Irish group of politicians from the 14th Ward. And they were rivals to the Daley politicians from the 11th Ward. Well, early 1950s, Clarence Wagner is an alderman, he's a committeeman, and Martin Connelly's the mayor, and Martin Connelly's basically window dressing. I mean, he looks like central casting, put him in to act as a mayor, and that's what he did. Sometimes he seemed like he was just acting. But anyway, Clarence Wagner practically ran a city. Well, the politicians figured Connelly had stepped on too many toes. He got Congressman Dawson from the South Side angry at him because he thought Kennelly was unfairly picking on his black constituents. So Dawson said, okay, we'll back Kennelly for one more term. In 1955, he's got to go. That's the end of Kennelly.
That's it.
So 1953 comes, 2 years before this, and there was going to be a meeting in the Central Committee of the Democratic Party, the Politburo, so to speak. And the acting chairman is stepping down, and according to the insiders, County Clerk Richard J. Daley is supposed to become the Duke chairman of the committee, and 2 years later, he will run against Kennelly in the primary, beat Kennelly, and of course become mayor. Yeah, well, they have this meeting behind closed doors, and in the meeting, Clarence Wagner stands up, and Clarence Wagner is well-liked. He's a very sophisticated person for a Southside Irishman of that time. Great orator. He had a very deep voice. They call him Gravels because he kind of, you know, comes up like this. And he
good,
says in this
impression, John.
Yeah, he said, thank you. He says in this closed-door meeting, well, wait a minute, let's delay this vote. So the meeting ends, and they come out, and this, of course, is the oral history that was told later, what happened is closed-door meeting. And they come out of the meeting, and everybody expects Richard J. Daley to be the new county chairman. And the reporters are saying, what happened? What happened? And he said, well, Daley giving his say, yeah, Clarence stood up, and he asked for this two-week delay, so we still got an acting chairman. Well, 2 weeks to maneuver, right? To
go on. Of course. That's what that's Chicago politics,
yeah,
right?
So Clarence and another friend of his, another politician, they decide they're going to go on a fishing trip out by Bronco Nagurski's place, northern Minnesota.
You're just getting all the names in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Talk about Nagurski's Corner another time. So anyway, the two of them go on this fishing trip, and they bring their young sons with. And somewhere on the trip, Clarence Wagner misses a turn, and he cracks the car up, his Cadillac up, turns over, and the passengers, he was driving, the passengers got out with minor injuries, but Clarence Wagner got killed.
Wow. So this was in the two-week time.
This was in the two-week time.
He had asked for a delay, went on a fishing trip, died on the fishing trip.
Right, right. And so they come back, and of course, by now, his group is all kind of splintered, and they make kind of a half last stand to try and do it. But Richard J. Daley does get named county chairman, and 2 years later he
becomes mayor, and the rest is history. And for that unfortunate demise,
yeah,
Chicago recognizes him with
a bridge here. And the irony of that is nobody thought of it at the time. We're naming an expressway bridge after somebody got killed in an auto accident. But this is the Clarence Wagner Memorial Bridge, and it was forgotten, actually, for many years.
Now, there's a postscript to this, because as this bridge, it gets forgotten because, of course, it's sort of overshadowed by the post office.
Yeah, and the Daley family, they're not going to try to publicize this.
But it's amazing to think about, because you said Wagner was part of the 14th Ward. It's interesting who replaced Wagner and the lineage since.
Yeah, the 14th Ward was then centered on Garfield Boulevard on Halsted Street, and it's moved further west with districting. Well, when he got killed, when Clarence got killed, a man by the name of, I think it was Joseph Burke, became the next alderman and committeeman, and he ruled the ward until he died in 1968. And then his son takes over, guy by the name of Ed Burke, who is now the longest-serving alderman in the history of the city of Chicago,
wow.
51 years in county.
So you can almost route back what happened to Clarence to Ed Burke being alderman today.
Yeah,
and the Daley dynasty. This man, who this bridge is named after, holds the key to a modern political Chicago history.
Yeah, and Ed Burke did recognize this. As I said, this had been forgotten, this bridge. And so in 2013, in the 60th anniversary of Clarence Wagner's death, Alderman Burke came out and they rededicated the bridge and they put a new plaque up, and I assume the plaque is still there in the Southwest Bridge House.
Okay, as we stand and we look at all the traffic going by, you can hear it in the background. As this is really a series about forgotten, hidden Chicago history, is there a chance that you could see the Clarence Wagner Bridge be renamed at some point because people forget their history?
Nah, they wouldn't do that in Chicago. Why would they do that? That'd be like changing the name of the city. We're not going to do that.
We're not going to do that. Now, before we wrap, you know, it's interesting because we were talking about how this is no longer Congress. Now it's Ida B. Wells. But it wasn't always called Congress.
No, it wasn't always Congress. Before it was Congress, it had actually been Tyler Street. It was one of those President Streets on the...
Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
We talk about all the President Streets
and,
downtown. Right.
The thing is, John Tyler, when the Civil War came, was for Virginia. And he joined up with the Confederacy. He wound up in Confederate Congress. So they changed the name of the street. And afterwards, when everybody was was making friends enough to, with each other, they declined to change the name back. So it's been Congress until recently.
John Schmidt, of course, our regular Extension 720 historian. We're talking about the hidden landmarks that are featured in your new book here on Extension 720. Today, the Clarence Wagner Bridge right before the old post office. Thanks, John.
Sure.
Chris Jones. I always like when she's a chief entertainment critic, theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune. Always love when Chris comes in, especially this time of year, because we can talk about some of the theater offerings coming up for this this new season. It looks like some great stuff. I don't know. He's not going to talk about it tonight, but I was over at Looking Glass yesterday, and my son is doing he was auditioning for their ensemble. And which is hilarious because it's early on in his auditioning career and there's still the same kind of weird energy that's in the room, even with the kids. I whispered, I didn't want to bother him, but I was going to say, hey, start doing some vocal exercises. You know, you got to start intimidating all these other kids. Start talking about the other auditions you've done. Oh my God, I haven't seen you since we did that other one. Oh, really loud. Be as loud as possible. No, but it was over there, and they have these. They do this great thing where, in their lobby, they kind of paint on the posters. The whole wall is a poster for the upcoming shows. And coming up in February, so we're not going to talk about it tonight, is a play about Jane Byrne. I know, it looks so good. I mean, it was just a painting of a picture of Jane Byrne, but still, I'm like, yeah, I'm in. So want to see that, right? Feel like that's going to be good. Again, going off of nothing besides a painted on press poster on the wall. That's all it takes to get me. I'm like, oh, that's Jane Byrne. Play about Jane Byrne. I'm in. Where do I buy tickets? Up in the front? I'm in. So that worked. I like to send a message to the Looking Glass saying it worked. Their marketing and advertising worked. Nothing else. There's nothing like. Not familiar too much with the playwright, anything like that. Just saw her face. I'm like, yep, I'm in. Yeah. I remember I was on the air. I was doing a talk show at a different radio station, and I was a fill-in. And it was like one of those where it's like, oh, we've got all of our stuff planned. So meticulous. When I worked at public radio and you were a fill-in, it was a lot more nerve-wracking because they didn't really let you do your thing. You're filling at WGN Radio. You get to do your thing. You know, like we kind of have a format on Extension 720, but when people fill in, they can just do their own thing. But you had to follow the format and almost, you know, do everything really specific, and it's a really producer-run type program. And like 10 minutes before we went on the air, the news came across that Jane Byrne had died. And I was like, I was probably the only person in the building that was excited. Not because she died. And remember, she was old. We knew she was getting up there. But this idea that I could be on the air and I could do my thing,
yeah,
to talk about a Chicago mayor and Chicago politics.
It's huge.
And, yeah, and we were able to get some people in studio and take calls and do the whole thing and talk about her legacy. But that was the one moment where you're like, after all the producers were like, I don't know. Was she was mayor? Who was she? And I'm like, I got it. I will do this. And then, of course, Greg Flamm and the swap meet. How that started. Remember the swap meet we used to do here in the download, but also on Cochran's show, which we should bring Greg back. I love when he comes in. I filled in for Steve not too long ago, and I brought Greg back in.
The best.
And people, just the lines lit up. Love that segment. But that started because we were talking about, wouldn't it be great to do this? And Greg texted in that he had the Mayor Jane Byrne coloring book.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And that's what started the swap meet.
I wonder if your experience hosting that show will be in the play.
Oh, yeah. They got to have that, the scene, right? Like maybe at the beginning, like a montage?
Yeah.
Yeah, welcome back to public radio. Jane Byrne died today. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? I was just watching something where they did that, where they had, I forgot what it was. Just recently, I just watched the beginning, and the beginning was all like clips, media clips, but they were kind of fake media clips. And I was like, oh, I would love one time to be honored with like a media clip. Remember that show Chicagoland that was on CNN? That Conkle did the voices for.
Yeah.
Well, they always did. You know, whatever the mayor was coming, whatever the mayor was doing. That was my Conkle. That was my voiceover in Chicagoland. In the meantime, media was whipping up in a frenzy, and then it'd be like cuts, and we got.
Oh,
like,
you were on?
The show that I was doing was in the cuts. I wasn't on, but I was. I think I was in the reflection in the mirror. I was in the booth. I was like had my hand up, like in 10 seconds, wrap up.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, it was Eric Zorn and Neil Steinberg.
Oh, that's a fun duo.
Yeah, very fun duo. Lots of calls saying, "Did he say what I thought he said?" That's classic Neil Steinberg. But yeah, I want to do that. I'd love to be.
What about being a being an actor in Love when Joe Swanberg did his.
Oh, right.
You know, your former coworker was on there.
And
Lauren Cohn, who's on South Side,
right? And I also remember wasn't Drummond who was the I think it's Pam Zekman in The Fugitive. When they ran out at the end in the Hilton, and he's coming out, and he's kind of like beat up, and they're all putting the mics in the face. It's all real.
Wasn't Bulldog Drummond?
Yeah, it was Drummond. Yeah,
Drummond and
I want to say Zekman.
I think Lester. Was it Lester Holt?
Maybe. It was the whole crew. The whole 80s crew was out in full force. They're like casting call for reporters. They're like, we're real reporters. We'll do it. It was like an ode. It was Andy Davis's ode to Chicago media. But they were all there. Like, when he comes out, they all got the mics. They do, like, a fake scrum to get him. All right, we'll take a break here. We'll get the headlines, and then we will come back. And Chris Jones, not talking about Jane Byrne. Other fall offerings. Extension 720, rolling along till 10 o'clock tonight. It's my pleasure to welcome in the studio Christopher Jones, the chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune. Great to see you, buddy.
How are you? I'm just moving my chair
there
down.
There you go.
Because I'm a short guy, but I'm not that short.
Good to see you, and I'm glad. It's funny, I was just telling to the audience that I didn't do much promotion because I didn't have a lot of faith you'd make it tonight.
Well, you know, I was in a show. At a show, but it was one of those crisp 80-minute shows, so I hot-footed it down Lakeshore Drive, and here I am.
No improv. They weren't, like, trying to make it longer.
No, I'm out. And, you know, there is no one faster than me at getting out of a theater.
Do the actors and the people involved in the show, when they see you, you're really just getting out of here because you can come on Extension 720,
That's
but they're
right.
Like, oh, no, he bolted out of here. He didn't like it. They take something else from your
exactly right
hasty exit.
Exactly right.
All right, so you did a great piece just last week about some of the offerings coming up for the fall. The fall is usually the traditional start of a theater season.
The big shows, the big guns come out, your Steppenwolf's, your Goodman's, your Broadway in Chicago, stuff like that. So we got a good fall. I mean, we got some good stuff. It's already started. Tonight, American Blues Theater, Five Presidents, about the day. There's the day that Bush, George W. Bush, Reagan, Carter, Ford, and Clinton were all in the same room.
Mm.
And that day was the funeral of Richard Nixon in California. And they were all in. So this play by Rick Cleveland, who is a longtime Chicago writer, also wrote a lot of West Wing and, just a really great TV writer.
Yeah, a lot
writer.
Of Emmy. He's an Emmy award winner.
Yeah, big-time TV writer. And he's written this funny play about these five presidents together. It was kind of fun tonight, you know, and Reagan is sort of getting, Reagan is older. And Jim Lemming played Reagan very sympathetically, sort of the picture of Reagan on the cusp of Alzheimer's, really. It was kind of a good show tonight, so that was fun.
The shows that you kind of pick for the fall, they run the gamut from sort of what we know to be the Broadway in Chicago and the stuff that's coming downtown and some of the celebrities that are coming in. But also, what I thought was interesting was just the idea that for the first time, it seems maybe in history, it seems Broadway in Chicago is branching out, and they're not necessarily just doing everything that is downtown. They're partnering with Timeline for something that would be, I guess, more of an off-loop fair.
Yeah, so what they're doing, which is sort of unusual, is this play called Oslo, which is by this writer called J.T. Rogers, a really good writer, very good playwright. I saw this in New York. And what it's about, if you remember, in 1993, it's about the peace accord in Oslo, which ended with Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shaking hands. You remember there's that famous photo with Bill Clinton sort of going, come on, you got to shake your hand. It's like pushing them together.
Get in the shot.
It's all my doing. And in fact, it wasn't all Clinton's doing. It was the really this anonymous Norwegian negotiator. So it's this interesting play about how in treaties, you know, it was sort of interesting because I was writing this piece just to, with all the business with Trump and the Taliban at Camp David just last week, you know, about that idea of the unsung negotiator changing history. That the people that change history are usually not presidents, they're usually the unsung negotiators. Right. And so that was that's I think a very promising play, and it's going to be done by Timeline, but it's going to be at the Broadway Playhouse, which is right by Water Tower, and they're going to, you know, Broadway in Chicago is going to sell it to its subscribers, so Timeline's going to play to like 30,000 people, which is a lot.
It is a lot. Is there significance in that? That is this something that might be a new model that you might see more off-loop theater companies here in Chicago getting some of the piece of the pie that downtown theater?
Well, I think that, you know, so what it is you get a very good play on Broadway. Plays don't really tour anymore. It's too expensive, and you can't really sell a play in a lot of markets. But you can in Chicago, because we're a smart city. People here like to see a good play. And so the theory here is really you take a hot play off Broadway, and instead of sticking it on the road, you get some very good Chicago actors to do it. And why not? And then it's marketed by Broadway in Chicago, who have some muscle, and they can deliver 20, 30,000 people, which, as you know, is more than often make it to a small Chicago off-loop show.
You see a lot that's in that Broadway Playhouse. There might be the Elvis play.
It's a real crap.
But it seems like they're going for the most common denominator, meaning they're trying to get as many people. So when you have someone like Timeline, who I love their stuff, but something that might be a little bit more, you know, straight ahead play, do they have to worry about that because audiences are used to the Harry Potter show?
I think Oslo is a difficult, you know, it's like Oslo, it's like the Chicago that we want Chicago to be, which is where people will go and see plays that are very smart and are very sort of balanced, and they're about sort of, you know, political change, and they're very thoughtful. You know, they're not super sexy. I mean, Oslo is being made into a big Hollywood movie. I would say in another year, we'll all be talking about it, probably get Oscars. Meryl Streep will probably be in it or something. You know, it's all of that's underway. But right now, it's here. And, you know, I say this a lot, but I mean it, that some of our actors in this town are every bit as good as any of those guys. And so, you know, I always like to see these local performers get a big opportunity downtown. You know, I think that's it's a really cool thing.
Well, I can't wait to see Meryl Streep play Yasser Arafat. I just think that's going to be, it's really going to push. There is this balance, you know, between what happens downtown and the off-loop stuff. And there's some theaters, and Steppenwolf kind of falls into that category, that kind of bridge it. Because they're a little bit out of the loop, and they still play true to their roots of being sort of from off loop, so they kind of lead the way when it comes to the big shows that are coming up in the fall. They're always coming up with good stuff.
So they've got, you know, Linda Way, which is this is the return of Ladysmith Black Mombazo, who I'm sure lots of people will remember, who they worked on a show. It's in the early 90s called The Song of Jacob Zulu. Did very, very well with Eric Simonson, who's an ensemble member there. You know, and they were big recording artists in the 90s.
And Paul Simon. They did the whole thing with Paul Simon.
Cape Man, right?
Graceland.
Graceland, that's right.
He was on that whole record.
The show was called Cape Man off the Graceland album. And they are still around. You know, I think the founder's still there, and I'm sure some of those guys are different now, but they're coming back, and they're all going to be performing at Steppenwolf. And it's interesting because the late artistic director at Steppenwolf, Martha Levy, really wanted to get this show done. So, and she died, you know, a couple of years ago now, so that tells you how long they've been planning this. So I am actually, I'm excited to see that. I think it's going to be a cool show.
How often is this a peek behind the curtain? I mean, are they thinking about their seasons, theater companies like the Goodman and Steppenwolf, years in advance?
Yeah, I think they're often thinking about them 2 years at least in advance. And when it comes to new musicals on Broadway, you know, like shows like, you know, there's this show The Devil Wears Prada, which is being made into a musical. I am hoping it's going to start here. hoping, shall we say, mm-hmm. at this moment. And, you know, as soon as next year, I think that would be really cool. That's Elton John writing the score. And that's been knocking around, well, you know, 4 or 5 years, because Elton John's got other stuff to do. So when he gets off stage, you're like, oh, maybe I'll write
maybe
a song.
I'll do this, yeah.
Maybe I won't yeah. tonight. Maybe I won't, because you know, they're going to have to wait.
Chicago has such a track record. You know, just recently Tootsie was here yeah. and did the tryout, and it was successful on Broadway and at the Tonys.
Yeah.
Broadway has to look at that and say, like, we don't want to mess with the formula. If they're starting new musicals, Chicago has to be the place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes they can be a bit dodgy. Like, we've got this. So coming up, I'm hoping for Devil Wears Prada, but also on the docket is the new Britney Spears musical, let's right. hope, I guess. So that's coming. That's going to be... You know, then there was going to be the Michael Jackson musical, which got, you know, postponed. Chose.
Why? I missed the news. Why?
Right. So, you know, sometimes these pop culture shows, you never yeah. kind of know what you're going to get. And then there's a big hit on Broadway right now, Moulin Rouge, which is really great. If you're going to New York, folks, it's well worth seeing. It's a lot, you know, it's not anything like dramatic complexity, but it's essentially the movie on stage with like 5,000 different jukebox songs, and that I think will be here. I mean, that's kind of the yeah. big, but that opened in New York this summer. It's like $600-700 a ticket now to get a good seat there. It's really expensive.
Well, let's take a break, and when I come back, I want to ask about, you know, because there's so many of the plays that are going to be in Chicago that are done by Chicago theater companies, but they're plays that have been done or they already had successful runs on, like, Oslo on yeah. Broadway. And what's the dichotomy, or what's the ratio of plays that have been successful and produced elsewhere versus new work right. that is coming out here in Chicago? Chris Jones. I give you a little formality. Chris Jones here on it's Extension 720, man. So we'll take a break here on 720 WGN. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Chris Jones is in studio, chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune. He writes not just about theater. He's no, always writing
mix
about
it up.
Provocative.
We mix it up.
The Year of the Chicago Theater.
Yeah.
This is the this has been the Chicago Cultural Affairs.
It's a Rahm thing.
Yeah, Rahm did the public art, and right. now it's the Year of Chicago right. Theater. Does that matter to the theater goer, or that kind of distinction that the city's putting their lens or shining a light on the Chicago theater scene?
I think it's been more important, not so much for Chicagoans, but for tourists. I was talking to somebody who works at a theater just the other day, and they were saying, you know, we finally got into O'Hare. You're collecting your bag, and you look up, and there's a poster for a show. And I think that it's been in terms of visitors who don't really know. You know, often visitors come here, they've no idea what we've got here in terms of live entertainment. And we've had a couple of good tourist shows. So, you know, people turn their nose up at these things, but not me, Justin, not me. So, you know, you've got this new Teatro Zinzani,
yeah, right.
Right? Big circus right there on Randolph Street. You have dinner, they fly your cheesecake at you, you know, the clown, you know, licks your bald head and then serves dinner on it, that kind of thing. Might actually do
somewhat
that.
Recommended. I like it.
Might actually do that. And so, you know, that's a good night out for people coming down to the Loop. And then there's also a new drag show, a drag theater in Motor Row, which is down on South Michigan Avenue, right by McCormick Place. So there's this thing open there called Lips, which is a drag theater. They've got 5 different shows. The drag ladies are different every night, and I had a good time there. It's very glamorous, and I was very nicely taken care of. They said, "Hello, you beautiful darling," when I walked in, and I like that. And then the other line that I like was they said, one of the queens says, "Now be nice to your queens, because if you are, they'll remove your makeup and then reapply it the correct way." Very funny. So so Lips is a good time, and so I'm all for these, some of these like shows where you don't yeah. not everybody wants to see Hamlet after all,
right?
And you know, we don't have a lot of stars here that people know, but I mean, there's you know, the King's Speech, which is going to be opening on Navy Pier. That's, you know, based on the movie. That's got the dude from Lady Edith's husband in Downton Abbey's in it. I like Downton Abbey. So that's going to, you know, that at least will draw a few tickets. And then it was funny, you know, I was talking to another guy in the theater who's looking for a star, and he said, well, I'm thinking of offering this role to John Huganacker, who's the guy in the Bud Light, you know, those Bud Light beer commercials where they have that whole, you know, I'm talking the king
yeah.
in the
band. Yeah.
I was like, well, does he sell a ticket? And he's like, well, he sells a beer. So
if you could just play that character, that would be great.
Yeah, he's right. Now he's going to play like, you know.
We were just talking about that on the podcast about that. But it's funny that Bud Light, that
That's
was so
thing,
successful
it's
that
a
they're
huge
like
thing.
Medieval comedy. You got to go with it. Stay with it. It sells light beer.
It's like you look at that. You go, how did that idea did that get idea? Approved?
And how did they go with the second season of it? Now that here comes football, right?
Right?
And now they're on the new ones. When they did the Bears Packers game, you're watching and it's just all of that. Here it's back. And you're like, oh. Well.
I keep watching it and it's the same gag, right? Basically in slightly different setting. And I'm like, wow.
Bud Light drinkers are like, that's me. I love it.
And it has nothing to do with the Bud Light, which is the key, right? Because right. the beer's so terrible. You've got to make people forget
what
the beer.
Can we do? Let's take them to, make, let's do a period
let's
piece.
Take them to the medieval era.
All right. So I asked a question right before the break about the concept of the ratio in Chicago. When you have a fall preview and there's so much great stuff and some of the stuff you've talked about, like we said with Oslo, already ran on Broadway.
Right.
And a lot of this stuff already has run in different places and now it's being remounted or touring here in Chicago. What's the ratio between that and new work and Chicago work that is specific to or unique to Chicago?
Well, I would say it's about, you know, there's a couple, it's about 50-50, I would say, that there's a lot of what, you know, that is pretentiously called devised work here. But then, you know, and then of course there's the whole improv wheel, which is new every night, baby. You know, you've got your Second City, they've got a new review. I didn't like that last main stage review one bit. So I'm happy that that's turning over. I do like the ETC review, and that's carrying on. So that's good. I always like it when that works out nicely. So they've got a new show coming this fall, so that's going to be good, I think. And then you've got new plays like there's a play, Dana H, which is opening actually on Monday at the Goodman Theatre, which is by Lucas Nath, who's a very well-established Broadway playwright. And it's about his own mother, who is a prison psychologist, who was later sort of abducted by one of the inmates that she'd been working with. And that's about all I know. I haven't seen it. I think it's had a pre-thing in LA, but this is basically the premiere. If it does well, I'm sure it will go to New York. So I always, you know, I'm all for having stuff first. And I always think Chicagoans, we like stuff first. We like to get our eyes on it before the great marketplace. Yeah.
My last question just is about, it felt like in the last, or maybe from 2016 or January 2017 to beginning of this year, the theater always speaks about the things that are happening around us, and it was all about Trump. Everything that was being, it was like, this is, maybe it's not, it's set somewhere else, but it's all about Trump. Has that died down? Are we at a point where we're now thinking about different topics and not necessarily talking about
it? You know, it's a really interesting thing. It's like, is that what people want? You know, most artists in Chicago are progressives, and most artists, and then many of them are very young, and many of them are ready to change the world with every show they do. And they're always irritated by the resistance of the audience, which sort of says, it's Friday night, I know who's president. I know what he's saying. I know all about it. Just give me a good time. And that's always a conundrum in Chicago theater because it can be, you know, a little overly earnest. And so sometimes, you know, people just want to laugh on a Friday night.
Or explore other topics. Meaning, it's not just about Trump or just about the current political climate.
That has just, it sucks up so much oxygen, you know. And it's interesting because there are some plays that are very small about couples and about, I saw one on Wednesday called Midsummer. Sweet little show about a love affair between two 30-year-olds. Very sweet. And I, you know, there's a room for everything. And not everybody wants to sort of, you know, hear the same noise when they, people also like to escape. And sometimes escape means just thinking about something else.
Chris Jones, always a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure, Justin.
Chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune, and hopefully will be joining us on the regular coming up here after the Sox season because we miss talking to you, buddy. All right, that's going to do it for Extension 720. We'll take our last break. Coming up, who's coming up? Who's up? Carm?
I'll just stick around. We'll talk about a few movies.
We got movies next week, Christian. No, Mark Carman coming in up next here on 720.
I don't see him, Justin. I don't see him. You tell me he's coming in, but I don't see him.